Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Inside the Effort to Fight Climate Change Beyond the Power Sector by Justin Warland. The transportation, manufacturing, and agriculture industries have received a fraction of the attention of the power sector in the fight against climate change, but together they account for more than twice the harmful pollutants that are emitted during the production of electricity in the United States. And as sources of clean energy, such as wind and solar, comprise more of the nation's power, many experts believe it's time to focus attention on those other sectors. Targeting industries such as aviation, trucking, and steel production will be critical to stopping global temperatures from rising to unsafe levels, according to a recent report from the Energy Transitions Commission, ETC, an international nonprofit comprised of activists and business leaders devoted to reducing carbon emissions. If we decarbonize the whole of power and electrify as much as possible, that will generate about half of all the carbon emissions we'll need, says ETC Chair Lord Adair Turner. But we'll still be left with sectors of the economy where we cannot electrify. To date, most efforts to address carbon emissions in these industries have come from individual companies. Shipping and trucking companies have invested in ways to reduce their fuel consumption, such as forming platoons by grouping trucks closer together, largely because it can lower their costs. Airlines have sought to replace old gas-guzzling airplanes with more efficient ones for the same reason, and experimented with biofuels. In the industrial sector, many companies have tested technologies that capture and store carbon dioxide, though few of the projects have gained traction. The few efforts that have cut across entire industries are particularly tentative, according to experts. An international agreement to slow aviation emissions, for example, set a cap on emissions that takes effect 5 years after the negotiations and remains limited to international flights. Exempting all domestic markets is a major omission. In the U.S., for example, where hopping between cities requires hundreds or thousands of miles of travel, domestic travel is expected to grow by nearly 30% in the next two decades, according to FAA data. While some airlines may be able to reduce their emissions slightly, most will comply with the agreement by purchasing carbon offset credits that fund projects to address climate change. The trucking industry faced new rules issued by the Obama administration in 2016 that called for a 25% cut in emissions over the following decade. But the regulations come as the total U.S. freight tonnage is expected to grow 35% in the same time period, according to a report from the American Trucking Associations, mitigating the overall impact of increased fuel efficiency. Without a more aggressive approach in these sectors, researchers say that global warming will easily exceed the 2 degrees Celsius maximum target for temperature rise by 2100 set in the Paris Agreement on climate change. A report from the ETC, which counts energy executives like Shell CEO Chad Holliday and environmentalists like Al Gore among its members, calls for a focus on both carbon capture and plant-based biofuels as potential ways forward. The carbon capture process takes carbon dioxide emitted in industrial processes and energy production and either stores it deep underground or uses it as raw material for new products like plastics and fuel sources. In industries like steel and cement production, where carbon dioxide is a byproduct, capturing carbon may be the only way to make a large dent in emissions. But the process is costly and complicated to implement, and industrial companies are unlikely to invest in it without some sort of financial benefit. Indeed, it is only in operation in 9 large-scale projects across the country. In response, many policymakers have called for a carbon tax to create a financial incentive for capturing emissions. Beyond a tax, companies might seek ways to put captured carbon dioxide to good use in other products or processes. The Trump administration has repeatedly cited the Petra Nova coal-fired power plant in Texas, which uses captured carbon dioxide to aid oil extraction, as an example of a way to put carbon dioxide to productive use. The plastics maker Covestro uses captured carbon dioxide to make mattresses, among other products. In the Industrial Revolution, we improved human productivity by a factor of 10, says Covestro CEO Patrick Thomas. Now we need to do the same with carbon dioxide. Biofuels, energy sources derived from plant matter, offer another path for transportation-based industries, and refiners of jet and diesel fuel have already begun making use of them. Typically, biofuels mix with traditional fuels as a simple way to reduce emissions. But biofuels come with their own set of environmental concerns. The federal government requires refiners mix ethanol, perhaps the most widely known biofuel, to reduce emissions in gas for consumer vehicles. But analysis from the National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences suggests that ethanol could actually lead to more carbon emissions than traditional gasoline when its entire life cycle is taken into account. Making any of these technologies possible on a transformational scale will require significant investment in research and development from both the public sector and private industry. And in the competition for America's public environmental research funds, the transportation and agriculture sectors tend to play second fiddle. It hasn't been the focus, but it needs to be, says Turner of Investment Beyond the Power Sector. You need public research and development. Vladimir Putin doesn't understand the limits of Donald Trump's power, by Simon Schuster. There are still many in Russia who take pleasure in watching the White House consumed by infighting and stumbling from one setback to another, most recently the failure to push through health care reform and the rapid hiring and firing of foul-mouthed communications director Anthony Scaramucci. But the more common feeling around the Kremlin these days might seem familiar to many Republicans. After observing Trump in office for more than 6 months, there's a mix of disappointment and foreboding. President Vladimir Putin seems particularly out of sorts. By now, he's realized that betting on Trump represents a mistake he has made before with Western leaders, and his decision on Sunday to expel hundreds of diplomats and other personnel from the U.S. Embassy in Moscow shows that he's ready to cut his losses. There was nothing more to wait for, his spokesman Dmitry Peskov said in explaining the decision on Monday. It was all pretty obvious. And Putin should have known better. His closest alliances with the West have all gone the same way. Whether it was Jacques Chirac in France, Silvio Berlusconi in Italy, or Gerhard Schröder in Germany, each was built on a personal rapport with an incoming head of state, always another man, usually also a blowhard. Each collapsed when that leader was confronted by the limitations of democracy, term limits, a free press, an independent legislature, an unhappy electorate, or any of the other checks and balances built into their constitutions. But with each new attempt at a friendship with the West, Putin seemed to hope that his counterparts could override these curbs on their authority the same way Putin has done in Russia. They have always let him down, though none quite as spectacularly as President Trump. The U.S. Congress sent Trump a veto-proof bill on July 27, imposing new sanctions on Russia for its alleged interference in the U.S. presidential elections last year, not even a month after the two presidents met for the first time during the G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany. To many in Moscow, the legislation proved Trump to be a feckless leader, unable to make good on his earnest promises to get along with Russia. Since Trump cannot handle his own lawmakers, it means he is weak, the Russian political analyst Alexei Makarkin wrote in an analysis of the sanctions bill. But the point Makarkin missed was the one that Putin also seems incapable of getting his head around, that members of the U.S. Congress, including the Republicans, are not Trump's own lawmakers. They represent a co-equal branch of government, much like the judiciary that has repeatedly blocked Trump's agenda on immigration. That confusion over the limits on executive authority goes back to the early years of Putin's presidency, when he established control over the Russian media and began to assume that his Western counterparts could do the same in their countries. During a summit in 2005 with then-President George W. Bush, Putin refused to believe that the U.S. Commander-in-Chief does not have the power to muzzle American journalists. "Don't lecture me about the free press," Putin said, according to Bush's memoir, "not after you fired that reporter." It took a moment for Bush to realize what Putin was talking about. "Vladimir," he said, "are you talking about Dan Rather?" The veteran broadcaster had been forced to apologize and resign from CBS News a few months earlier, not due to any White House fiat, but because of a flawed report on Bush's service in the National Guard. In Putin's eyes, the incident showed that the American posturing about freedom of the press was a charade. Bush tried to set him straight. "I strongly suggest you not say that in public," he recalls telling the Russian president. "The American people will think you don't understand our system." But that's just it. He doesn't. A few years into my stint as a reporter in Moscow, I lost track of the number of officials who tried to explain to me that there is no such thing as an independent journalist. One official even started our interview by exclaiming that American reporters are all just secret agents in disguise. This is how Pavel Astakov, then the Kremlin ombudsman for children's rights, greeted me one afternoon in 2013. "The CIA is here," he shouted, laughing to his assistant. "Send him in." He wasn't entirely kidding. In Russian officialdom, and among the public generally, people often assume that the West functions a lot like Russia, with a tame judiciary, a subservient media, and a ruling clique that pulls all the strings. This view of the world makes it easier to brush away foreign criticism. If everyone is corrupt, no one has the right to judge. But a lot of very senior officials in Moscow also happen to believe this. They tended to believe, for instance, that Trump would be able to override the other branches of government in pursuing his agenda, especially when it comes to easing U.S. sanctions against Russia. On a deeper level, they believe that power in the U.S., like in Russia, is concentrated in the hands of the executive, while the rest is mostly democratic window dressing. And that conviction is not likely to budge amid the latest lesson in American civics. On Russian state television channels, Trump's failure to silence the media and force his agenda through Congress and the courts has simply been cast as further proof that the U.S. is run by some all-powerful cabal, only this time the cabal has turned on the U.S. president. It is a new twist on a familiar narrative, and it suggests that the Kremlin still holds out hope for Trump getting a grip on the American system and steering it toward an alliance with Moscow. "We have fed the hope that the situation will change," Putin lamented on Sunday in a televised interview, "but it seems that if this change does come, it won't be soon." How Anthony Scaramucci Spent His 10 Days in the White House, by Alana Abramson and Maya Roden. Anthony Scaramucci was axed as the White House Communications Director Monday, just 10 days after he assumed the role. Scaramucci had a tumultuous, albeit brief, tenure in the White House. Each day, it seemed, brought either a new revelation about him or a controversy of his own making, such as his profanity-laced interview with The New Yorker. Here's a look at the highlights of his 10-day career as Trump's communications director. July 21st, Scaramucci steps in for Sean Spicer. After being announced as the new communications director, Scaramucci held a press conference in the White House briefing room where he said he will spend the next few weeks getting acquainted with the employees in the West Wing. He also addressed reports of tension with Reince Priebus, Trump's then chief of staff, saying their rivalry was unfounded. We are a little bit like brothers, where we rough each other up once in a while, which is totally normal for brothers. There's a lot of people in here who have brothers, so you get that, but he's a dear friend, Scaramucci said. July 22nd, the Mooch deletes old tweets. Scaramucci, also known as the Mooch, announced on Twitter that he was deleting his old tweets in an effort to be fully transparent as communications director. He had previously tweeted about issues at odds with the White House's agenda, like support for Hillary Clinton and advocating for gun control. Past views evolved and shouldn't be a distraction, he wrote on Twitter. I serve POTUS agenda, and that's all that matters. July 23rd, he refers to Sarah Huckabee Sanders' hair and makeup. Scaramucci made the rounds on network and cable Sunday talk shows, discussing his upcoming strategy and plans to clamp down on leaks from the White House. We'll see how they do with me at the helm, he told Fox News' Chris Wallace about White House staffers. If the leaks don't stop, I'm going to pare down the staff because it's just not right. While discussing Sarah Huckabee Sanders' new role as press secretary, he made a comment that drew criticism for sexist undertones during an interview on CNN's State of the Union. Sarah, if you're watching, I love the hair and makeup person that we had on Friday, so I'd like to continue to use the hair and makeup person, he said. Scaramucci later took to Twitter, saying that he was referring to his own hair and makeup. For the record, I was referring to my hair and makeup and the fact that I like the makeup artist. I need all the help I can get, he tweeted. Hashtag humor. July 24th, the return of on-camera press briefings. After weeks of the White House prohibiting televised press briefings, Scaramucci announced on Twitter that he was changing the policy and would revive the on-camera updates. He also traveled with Trump to West Virginia, where the president gave his now infamous political speech at the Boy Scout Jamboree. Scaramucci posted several pictures from Air Force One on Twitter. It will never get old, he wrote of the experience. July 25th. Life on Air Force One. For the week, Scaramucci was a regular fixture on Air Force One. One day after traveling with the president to West Virginia, he accompanied him to Ohio, posting several more pictures from the plane on Twitter. July 26th, White House infighting with Reince Priebus. Scaramucci sent a tweet insinuating that his White House rival Reince Priebus had leaked his financial disclosure form, which was the subject of a Politico report. In light of the leak of my financial disclosure info, which is a felony, I will be contacting the FBI and Justice Department, #swamp, at Reince45, Scaramucci tweeted. His tweets sparked speculation that he was asking law enforcement to investigate Priebus for the leak, causing him to send a follow-up tweet disputing that. Wrong. Tweet was public notice to leakers that all senior administration officials are helping to end illegal leaks. July 27th, the New Yorker interview. Scaramucci started the day with a call into CNN's New Day, blasting leaks to the media and comparing his relationship with Reince Priebus, who was still serving as Trump's chief of staff, to Cain and Abel. Later in the day, the Mooch continued his tirade against Priebus, calling him a paranoid schizophrenic who had cock-blocked him in a vulgar call with the New Yorker. In that same conversation, Scaramucci threatened to fire the entire White House communications team in an effort to rid it of leakers. I fired one guy the other day. I have 3 to 4 people I'll fire tomorrow. I'll get to the one person who leaked that to you. Reince Priebus, if you want to leak something, he'll be asked to resign very shortly, he said in the interview. July 28th, Scaramucci's wife files for divorce and Reince Priebus resigns. 1 week into Scaramucci's role as communications director, it appeared that he'd won the battle against his longtime rival Priebus, who resigned the White House chief of staff position on Thursday. While things seemed to be smoothing over in Scaramucci's professional life, the New York Post reported that there was also turbulence in his personal life. According to the tabloid, his wife of 3 years had filed for divorce because of his naked political ambition. Amid the report, Scaramucci tweeted that civilians should be off limits. Leave civilians out of this. I can take the hits, but I would ask that you would put my family in your thoughts and prayers and nothing more. July 29th. More details about his wife, Deidre Ball, emerge. More details emerged about Scaramucci's wife, Deidre Ball, 38, who reportedly filed for divorce in the ninth month of pregnancy. When his wife gave birth to their son on July 24th, Scaramucci wasn't there and was instead on the road in West Virginia with Trump, according to the Post. He allegedly texted his wife, "Congratulations, I'll pray for our child," when their son was born, but a representative for Ball told the New York Times that was not true. July 30th, John F. Kelly takes over Team Trump. One day before retired Marine General John Kelly was set to take helm of the Trump's team, questions began swirling about if White House staffers, including Scaramucci, would report to the new chief of staff. When Priebus was in charge, Scaramucci made clear that he reported directly to the president, not Priebus. In interviews, both Mick Mulvaney, director of the Office of Management and Budget, and senior White House advisor Kellyanne Conway would speak for their other colleagues, though they said they would follow the new chief's orders. July 31st, Scaramucci is fired. A few hours after Kelly was sworn in, the New York Times reported that Scaramucci was out as communications director. According to the Times, General Kelly had requested his removal. In a statement, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said Scaramucci was leaving his role because he thought it was best to give Chief of Staff John Kelly a clean slate and the ability to build his own team. Somebody stole Neil Armstrong's solid gold lunar module replica, by Alana Abramson. A solid gold replica of a NASA lunar module has been stolen from an Ohio museum honoring American astronaut Neil Armstrong, police say. The police department in Wapakoneta, Ohio, Armstrong's hometown and the location of the Armstrong Air and Space Museum, said in a Facebook post that it was told Friday the artifact had been stolen from the property. The replica was made by Cartier in Paris, the police said, and given to Armstrong as a gift after the historic Apollo 11 moon landing in 1969. Only three such replicas exist. Cartier made one for Armstrong and two more for Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins, the other two Apollo 11 astronauts. Armstrong, the first human to walk on the surface of the moon, passed away in 2012. The value of such an item cannot be determined, the police said in a statement. Authorities are asking for the public's assistance in locating the item. The museum was closed Saturday, according to its Facebook page. It will reopen Sunday afternoon. The truth is that you can't steal from a museum. Museums don't own artifacts. We are simply vessels of the public trust, the museum wrote on its Facebook page. Theft from a museum is a theft from all of us.
Here are the four books Mark Cuban is reading this summer. Authored for Money by Brad Tuttle. Mark Cuban, the billionaire entrepreneur, Dallas Mavericks owner, and star of TV Shark Tank, turns 59 on Monday. He shares July 31st as a birthday with actor Wesley Snipes and author J.K. Rowling, among others. But Cuban isn't reading any of Rowling's Harry Potter books lately. He doesn't seem to be interested in breezy books to read on the beach either. Instead, Cuban's 2017 summer reading list consists mostly of dense, deeply researched works that shed light on current events. Cuban told Politico, quote, "I'm trying to keep up with what's happening around the world, so my reading has been a little more eclectic than past summers." Here are the four books Cuban told Politico that he's reading at the moment. The first is Machine Learning for Dummies by John Paul Mueller and Luca Massarone. This edition of the For Dummies series covers the basics of how machines now handle everyday tasks, such as producing credit scores, filtering email spam, and creating targeted ads on the web in real time. Cuban made much of his fortune in software, in tech, and presumably he's trying to keep up to speed with how computers and automation are being used to tackle a wide variety of jobs today. Next is Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin, by Fiona Hill and Clifford C. Gaddy. Russian President Vladimir Putin, the former KGB agent who has been the country's unquestioned leader for nearly two decades, is easily one of the world's most powerful men. He could secretly be the richest person on Earth as well. This biography offers a deep psychological profile of Putin, who many believe was at least aware of Russian efforts to hack the 2016 U.S. elections, and who President Trump has praised as a, quote, strong leader and very smart. Third on the list is The True Believer, Thoughts on the Nature of Mass Movements by Eric Hoffer. First published in 1951, The True Believer remains a seminal tome analyzing the roots of how and why individuals embrace mass movements, including religious and political ideas that seem extremist and nonsensical to outsiders. The book was the first written by Hoffer, who worked as a longshoreman and became a celebrated philosopher, intellectual, author, and received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from Ronald Reagan shortly before his death in 1983. Readers today say that the book still offers remarkable insights into human behavior and sheds light on why people might, for instance, sympathize with terrorists or support a dangerous demagogue as a national leader. And finally, the fourth book on the list is White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America by Joan C. Williams. Why did the white working class overwhelmingly support Donald Trump in the 2016 election? And why is the media's understanding of this demographic mostly misguided and condescending? This is the ground covered in the recently published book by Williams, a professor at the University of California Hastings College of the Law, who, according to the Harvard Business Review, quote, has written a blunt, bracing narrative that sketches a nuanced portrait of millions of people who have proven to be a potent political force, end quote. This article was written for Money Magazine, A Brand of Time, by Brad Tuttle. AMD's RX Vega PC gaming graphics lineup is late but mighty, authored for Time Tech by Matt Peckham. In the crazy high-end PC gaming graphics card market, you have two choices, AMD or NVIDIA. NVIDIA presently commands the performance roost with cards at the tip-top of its GeForce 10 series. AMD has trailed its rival at this level for years, opting to instead do battle in the market's budget and mainstream tiers. That's about to change with the advent of AMD's Radeon RX Vega series. The Sunnyvale-based chipmaker just unveiled a parade of cards based on its Vega architecture, first announced earlier this year at CES 2017. Vega means faster clock processors and radically overhauled memory subsystems to improve metrics like minimum frame rates and performance hiccups in games. AMD calls the latter feature High Bandwidth Memory 2. The new series of Vega-based cards will launch August 14th and start at $399, running up to $699 for a liquid-cooled pack leader. It's a paper launch, mind you, so we're getting family tiers, specifications, and suggested retail prices, but no independent benchmarks. It's best to treat AMD's claims, which show marked improvements over NVIDIA's GTX 1080, as ballpark figures. In other words, those claims for its $499 mid-range RX Vega 64, the tailing integer signifying its number of compute units, emphasize minimum frame rates, a conservative but in some ways more insightful metric that, if accurate, illustrates Vega's focus on frame rate fluidity while providing a practical sense of where the bottom lies. The only glaring omission is a 4K comparison, but we'll get that soon enough. Look for the $699 liquid-cooled version of the Vega 64 to perform markedly better and presumably be the overclocker's choice, and the entry-side $399 Vega 56 with fewer texture units and lower memory clock to slot lower. AMD also plans to offer bundled versions that include both hardware and software. Say you're looking to build a new PC from the ground up. These packs include discounts on select monitors that support AMD's FreeSync tech, as well as AMD motherboards and bundle copies of Prey, and a voucher for Wolfenstein 2 The New Colossus, Bethesda's new alt-history shooter that's due October 27th. You can add $100 to the Vega 56 and 64 prices above to get their respective pack version costs, while the liquid-cooled Vega 64 is only available as part of a pack for $699. This article was authored for Time Tech by Matt Peckham.
How to write emails that actually get answered. by Kathleen Murray Harris for Real Simple. Email, it's the thing we love to hate, or at least complain about, but it's also the key to new opportunities. Emails matter because they're how doors open and close all day long, says Danny Rubin, author of Wait, How Do I Write This Email? Whether you're looking for a new job or reconnecting with an old boss, networking experts share exactly what to write and not to write to get the response you're hoping for. Personalize your message. Reference a commonality in your opening line, how you met, a mutual interest, or a shared connection. Same goes for your subject line, says Blair Desimbrelli, LinkedIn career expert. Avoid vague language such as seeking advice or looking to connect. Get to the point. The shorter the message, the higher the response rate, says Desimbrelli. Be clear and conversational and say exactly why you're writing. Tease attached information like a cover letter if you have more to say. Ask a question they want to answer. Grab someone's attention by asking a question they haven't heard a million times. If you're interviewing for a job at the person's company, write, I know you work at X company. What was the hardest interview question they asked you? Remember, you're talking to a person. Don't make immediate demands on someone's time, connections, or brain power, says J. Kelly Hoey, author of Build Your Dream Network. Instead of suggesting coffee right away, express your appreciation for the other person's time and let them take the lead for next steps. Be honest with an old acquaintance. Hoey suggests acknowledging that it's been some time since you've spoken, saying that you've been keeping up with her career and providing a quick update on what's happening in your life, both at home and at work. Write, because you helped me so much with my career, I just wanted you to know that this happened. Make it mobile-friendly. Consider the time of day and the device on which someone is reading your email, says Hoey. A nightly train commuter, or anyone really, may zone out on a multi-paragraph email. Bullet points and short sentences work best. Stay top of mind. If you met someone at an event, send a connection request or email within 24 hours while your meeting is still fresh in the person's mind. You don't have to make a specific ask. Simply writing, it was nice to meet you, is valuable and will help you capitalize on a future networking opportunity, says Hoey. Sign off smartly. After studying more than 350,000 email threads, Brendan Greenlee, a data scientist at the email productivity company Boomerang, found that showing appreciation in an email closing inspired more people to reply. Thanks in advance, thanks, and thank you all delivered higher response rates than the ubiquitous best or regards. Be patient. Yes, we live in an always-on world, but you have to let business take its natural course. In most cases, give the person 48 hours before sending a follow-up. Still no answer? Try reaching out by phone just in case the messages ended up in their spam folder, says Ruben. If they don't answer after that, it's time to move on. There are plenty of other connections in the sea. This article originally appeared on realsimple.com. Australia arrests four men plotting to bring down an airplane, by Alana Abramson. Australian authorities arrested four people suspected of planning to bring down an airplane in a terrorist attack, Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull said Sunday. This is an example of the outstanding work that is conducted by the Joint Counterterrorism Team, Turnbull said in remarks broadcast by Australia's ABC News and posted on his official Twitter account. The tight cooperation and collaboration between our security and intelligence agencies is the key to keeping Australians safe from terrorism. The Australia Federal Police said in a statement that four men were arrested in the operation. All are currently in custody amid ongoing investigations. We face a range of terrorist threats, Turnbull said. Some of them are lone actors who activate very quickly and with very little warning. On other occasions, you get quite elaborate conspiracies. This appears to be in that category. Turnbull also said police had seized a considerable amount of material as part of the raid. He said additional security measures were implemented at Sydney Airport earlier in the week and that more airfields had increased security overnight. Turnbull had said in a statement Saturday that authorities were conducting operations to disrupt plans for terrorist attacks in Australia, but did not provide any details in the statement about the plot or the number of arrests.
I Will Forever Be an American Soldier by Kara Milstein, Katie Steinmetz, and Kim Bubalo. No one knows for sure how many transgender people have served in America's armed forces or are currently in uniform. But on July 26th, President Donald Trump made it clear that he does not believe they should be allowed to serve in any capacity. In a series of tweets, Trump argued that medical costs for transition-related care are too burdensome, and that having transgender people in the military causes disruption. The move seemingly reinstated a ban on open service that former President Barack Obama decided to lift last year, ending decades of what some describe as serving in silence. The Pentagon says it is delaying action until it receives further guidance from the White House. Politicians, advocacy groups, and LGBTQ individuals decried President Trump's announcement. Meanwhile, transgender troops currently serving are struggling to understand what the president's decision will mean for them in the immediate future. Among those who felt most blindsided by the reversal were transgender veterans who, by some estimates, number more than 130,000 in the U.S. Here, 9 transgender troops and veterans respond to President Trump's announcement. "We as a people must unite." Akira Wyatt, age 25, serving in the Navy at Camp Pendleton, California. "I'm currently an active duty servicewoman. I have always had a strong lineage of military presence in my family. My dad is a proud and honorable Marine veteran who not only taught me to serve with honor, but with truth to self and country." President Donald Trump's tweet came as a major realization that we as a people must unite for a better cause. "We are in a pivotal moment in our history which will determine how our future generations will carry on the torch of our country. I do believe that our government and its people will make the right decision for our country's future." Transgender people have served and died for this country. Jordan Blisk, age 23, served in the Air Force at Grissom Air Reserve Base, Indiana. "I'm a fifth-generation serviceman, and my family has a tradition of honorable military service. I enlisted originally to pay for school and give me opportunities I didn't have elsewhere. I am disgusted with the announcement. Transgender people have served and died for this country for decades without recognition or support. By the commander-in-chief legitimizing transphobia and bigotry through military policy, he legitimizes it in the public sphere as a whole." An assault on the marginalized. Caden Davis, age 21, serving in the Army National Guard in Palmetto, Florida. "My service means a great deal to me. I take pride from laying down the widely accepted stereotype that my generation has an inability to exhibit selfless behavior. One of the founding mantras of military service is just that, selfless service. My twin brother, who is currently stationed at Patrick Air Force Base, has equally committed himself to the defense of his country. It is difficult for me to accept that one of us is free to serve his country honorably while the other cannot. When news reached me of President Trump's ban on transgender service, I was dejected and humiliated, to say the least. This assumption that transgender soldiers are unfit to serve is not a personal attack against me, but an assault on the marginalized LGBT populace. The ramifications of this ruling, should it come to pass, would entail stripping capable soldiers of their part in the defense of this country. It is in our core." Madeline Martinez, age 28, served in the Army at Fort Bliss, El Paso, Texas, and Fort Stewart, Hinesville, Georgia. "My heart goes out to any military brothers and sisters who want to serve their country but now won't be able to do so. Being transgender isn't a choice. It is in our core that makes us exist as human beings. President Trump is not only banning Americans who want to serve, he is discriminating against a minority group who have been having to hide their gender issues in the service due to the discrimination and hardship that come along with being openly transgender. These are individuals who are crucial to the missions and follow the warrior ethos. I will always place the mission first. I will never accept defeat. I will never quit. I will never leave a fallen comrade. Yet President Trump is taking these soldiers out of their positions, out of their jobs, and out of their mission to serve the American people. He is telling the world that transgender individuals in America do not have the same rights as most of the American public. As a president, he is to accept all of the people who fall under the American flag. The military needs to stay united. Emery Van Brokhuizen, age 35, serving in the Army Reserve at Denver, Colorado. The service to me is all about having the integrity to be courageous. In the past year, my choice to continue to serve my country had become a small act of courage. Now, I am even more sure that my presence will continue to challenge those around me. The announcement was shocking, but mostly because of what it says to our transgender service members and citizens as a whole. Divide and conquer is not something that should happen within. The military needs to stay united in order to stay strong. I was afraid of who I was. Kara Zajic, age 29, served in the Navy at Fort Meade, Maryland. What does my service mean to me? Everything. Without the military, I would not be who I am today. I joined because I was afraid of who I was, a trans woman. The Navy is what gave me the courage and power to be myself and be accepted as myself among my peers. When I heard Trump's announcement, I was angry and sad. The military is a great organization that teaches you that as long as you can do your job, it doesn't matter who you are. I will forever be an American soldier. Jaycion Taylor, age 20, serving in the Army in Seoul, South Korea. My service means everything to me, as it should. I have watched my father serve his country as a United States Marine for over 20 years. I came out as a trans man in 2016 before the ban was lifted and always thought that I would not be able to do what I wanted in life because it would compromise my happiness and who I am. Later that year, an Army recruiter got in touch with me stating that the ban was lifted and that I did not have to choose anymore, and that was the happiest day of my life. Once I got to Korea, it took me about 3 months for me to be diagnosed with gender dysphoria and start hormone treatment. My peers and commanders have just started to use the proper pronouns with me and give me nothing but support. Now, it's like all of this was for nothing. The doctor's appointments, the long conversations with my peers, the time and energy spent on the readiness of all of this. I am capable of protecting my country despite what I'm going through mentally and physically. How I define myself should not ban me from serving my country. If I'm protecting everyone, why is no one protecting me? My name is Jaycion Taylor, and no matter what happens, I forever will be an American soldier. My service is my life. Kimberly Morris, age 47, served in the Marine Corps in Iraq. My service is my life. I enlisted out of college and spent the rest of my life in service of the defense of this nation. I guess I bought into the ideals that our country was founded on: democracy, freedom, equality, liberty. Those meant something, and I was proud to help perpetrate those ideals overseas while protecting them here at home. To this day, I continue to serve as a contractor working for the Department of Defense in the Pentagon. The difference is that I am happier and more eager to give back to the organization that has allowed me to live authentically for the first time in my life. Fortune 500 companies get it. I am shocked that the president does not. I was disgusted at Trump's announcement. I know many of the brave men and women still serving. They are the best of the best. We are pushing away very talented people, not because they cannot do the job, but because they are different. My patriotism and service should not have an asterisk attached to it. I answered my nation's call and served honorably, just as my brothers and sisters are currently doing. I will never quit. Lauren Greenford, age 23, serving in the Army at Fort Hood, Texas. I've served 2 years in the Army as a signal officer at Fort Hood. When I heard the news, I felt guilty at the thought of my brothers and sisters in arms deploying soon without me. The time is 1442 and I'm still serving, following our warrior ethos. I will never quit. I'll step down when I'm given a more official order.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.